And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Dr. TJ, and with me, as always, is Aaron. Take it away, Aaron.
Today, we'll be discussing why the U.S. has a shorter life expectancy than other high-income countries and solutions to live a long and healthy life.
I am baffled. Holy cow. That is amazing. Yes. Wow. She took over, ladies and gentlemen. And that's Aaron, the partner in crime over here. All right. So, yeah. So, why the U.S. has shorter life expectancy? This is a topic that we've actually had several questions that kind of, this is kind of the answer.
Right. Well, a lot of people just write in and they're complaining, like, why is the U.S., like, why are we so much worse off than...
Yeah. Why do we spend so much in healthcare compared to the rest of the world? Why do we take so many more medications? Why
right.
do, you know, I mean, there are...
Just kind of, and a lot of times they're supporters of the show. Like,
right.
we totally agree with you. But, I mean, because it's come up so much, we're like, let's really look into this and see, you know, where do we rank and how do we compare with other, you know, high-income countries?
Right. And so... That's what we did, and so we gathered up a bunch of information, and that's what we're going to talk about on today's show. So, you know, what's really truly disheartening to me is the fact that the U.S. is spending almost twice as much on healthcare than other developed high-income countries that, you know, like that we are comparing ourselves to. Now, these aren't just, you know, these are countries like Europe, European countries, Great Britain, France, Germany, Netherlands, Sweden, Switzerland, Denmark, Australia, Japan, and Canada. Now, obviously, Japan and Canada don't fall in the Europe or Australia fall in the Europe thing. But these are the 10 other countries that the United States is constantly compared with. We're like the top 11 countries in the world when it comes to income and when it comes to, you know, the things that we're comparing ourselves to. And so what's interesting is we fall dead last in a lot of these in a lot of the categories
right.
that we're going to talk about.
So yeah, so why
except
are we spending?
For spending, we're first
right.
by almost double.
Right. And that's crazy. You know, I mean, we've got a lower life expectancy, but we're spending almost double on healthcare.
Right.
Why is that?
And it's not only healthcare. Well, it is healthcare, but the facets of that healthcare, we're spending way more on prescription medication. We're spending way more on diagnostic testing. We're spending way more on doctor salaries. And what's very interesting to me, we're spending way more on the administrative costs of healthcare. I mean, the system is broken, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
And
which makes sense to me. I mean, if anyone has gone through like a surgery or, you know, recently having a baby, I mean, the amount of different bills and the different people you've got to go through for all of this, you're thinking, okay, I get why there are such high administrative costs.
Yeah.
It's insane how much goes into just getting everything processed.
Right. I mean, we just went through it. I mean, we got bills from all kinds of different places for our little guy. And I have no idea how many people had to see that bill before it finally got to us.
Right.
But, I mean, we're
and
getting
them
from...
And then eventually we got a refund check, and I'm just like, okay, well, how did that... I mean...
How did that happen?
Right. This, I mean, so clearly it at least went through one place twice because they had to... I mean, it just... You're thinking there has to be an easier way. I mean... This is not can't be the smartest way of doing things.
No, it is not. So, you know,
it certainly wasn't from the patient's perspective, who never knows when the bills are going to end,
right?
Or if they're right or if they're not right. And,
right. Well,
and I'm
just...
someone who's really on top of things. Every time I called and said, "What is this for? What did insurance cover?" And it still, I mean, there was obviously still a mess up. So
right.
nobody. Really seems
right.
to
and, have and we'd gotten a bill like 2 weeks before the refund check came.
Right.
Like, what? So
no
I'm
sense.
Expecting another one. I'm expecting another refund because I can't fathom that they processed this stuff in 2 weeks and it worked out. But I mean, the U.S. basically, when we start looking at, you know, this, our life expectancy in the United States is down. We're lower than other countries. And there are a lot of researchers out there, they like to point fingers. That's what researchers like to do. They like to, you know, get their data and then calculate that all up and then try to blame everything else. But the things that are being pointed at, things like we have a higher level of poverty in the United States. We don't have as much social services in the United States compared to these 10 other countries. But the one thing that intrigues me and I think doesn't get enough attention is lifestyle choices are playing a huge role in our decreased life expectancy rates. I mean, think about it. We're choosing as a population to eat crappier foods, more highly processed, more sugar, more junk, and we're choosing to not exercise.
Well, okay. I mean, I somewhat disagree with the choice. I mean, first of all, there is a lot of areas of the United States where health food is extremely difficult to find. We have made, unhealthy processed foods a lot cheaper than, high quality foods. It is difficult to get high quality foods.
I still, my point on this is still that we decide things with where we spend our money. If people just stop spending their money on potato chips for a week, there would be a significant shift in potato chips. If we stopped purchasing gasoline, there would be a significant shift in gasoline. This is all what we spend our money on. I mean, we go to sports and entertainments and things like that, and the fees for those are exorbitant. Why? Because we're willing to pay it. If we just stopped doing it, and that's what would shift things. I mean, the demand for more nutritional foods, more gluten-free foods, more fruits and vegetables, more organic, has caused the grocery stores in this country to carry more of that. I mean, you can go to Little Podunk Nowheres and find, even if it's a small section, you can find that. And if more people would buy those things, I promise you, that store in Little Podunk Nowhere, United States of America, they would buy more of that and supply that to their customers. It's supply and demand. It's simple.
I understand what you're saying.
She backed out. She's like, I don't want to take this argument.
Well, I just think, I mean,
I'm not disagreeing with you.
It's, I'm not saying that there isn't personal responsibility, but I'm saying that it's not that simple to say, oh, well, you just need to make better choices. I mean, in a way it's that simple, but it also, what about the, a single mother out there in a small town that does not, what is she going to drive 30 miles to go and get food? I mean, it just...
That's a valid point. I'm not discrediting that.
Circumstances that we don't necessarily make it easy to make decent choices.
True.
But
we could decide as a country to subsidize things like broccoli and carrots rather than corn and soybeans.
I get that. But I mean, on a personal basis, what can you do about that?
Vote.
Well, I mean, I get that. But you see what I'm saying? It is what it is right now.
Right.
So, I mean, I just think there's arguments on both sides.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. But another thing that is a piece of this is if we dive into stuff like the happiness study. Basically, in a nutshell, the happiness study was a study that found that our social connections and things like that are more about have more to do with our happiness than the amount of money that we have in a bank account is really what that boils down to. I mean, we could go through the whole study. I don't want to spend a lot of time on there. You can go read about that for yourself. But I mean, we as a country, we don't have as many friends as we used to have. We don't spend as much time with our family as we used to spend. And happiness overall is down. I mean, just go out on the freeway system and look at the road rage that's out there. I mean, we are not a happy country. And then we can also look at things like there are areas of the world that are referred to as blue zones. There's a place in Italy. There's a place in Greece. There's a couple other places. These areas are places where people live over 100 years on average. So what are they doing differently than what we're doing in the United States? I mean, that's the sort of stuff that we need to, I feel, that we need to move towards in, how we look at health and how we live in the United States. We're way too, what's the word I'm looking for? Way too stressed. We're way too focused on things that really don't contribute to our happiness. That's my take.
Right.
So what is life expectancy? A lot of people may not understand, that life expectancy, they get the picture that it's how long I'm expected to live if I am born today.
Right.
How long am
like
I statistically?
Average, yeah.
But there are a lot of things that go into this. I mean, they look at the death rates, they look at the birth rates, they look at the rates of sicknesses that are going on, your risk factors, you know, your socioeconomic status. There's a lot of things that go into these life expectancy numbers. But they have to be able to predict the death rates for future years as well. So, you know, they're predicting, like, if you were born today, they're also predicting your death rate at 20 years from now throughout your life. That's what they're doing. It's a very complex statistical thing that, I mean, I understand some statistics. I'm not even going to pretend that I understand right. this stuff. Because, I mean, and what's crazy is that they're not far off. I mean, these guys are predicting today, 80 years from now, they're going to be correct
right.
for what their predictions were, because that's about what the life expectancy is. So basically, it's just how long the average person will live. And, you know, that means that's average. That's 50%. So 50% of the population is going to live less than that. And that's where I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what can we do to help that 50% of the population that isn't going to live that long? I mean, chronic disease is just rampant in this country. How can we decrease the rates and risks of chronic disease and help that 50% live longer? That's my thought. I don't know. I mean, when you compare the U.S. to other countries, I mean, just this last March, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, found life expectancy in the U.S. was the lowest of all 11 high-income countries. And those are the same countries that I listed off before. The life expectancy in the U.S. is 78.8 years, while when we get into our peers, these other 10 countries, somewhere between 80.7 and 83.9. So we're looking at 2 to 5 years longer lives in other countries than in the United States, but yet we're spending twice the amount of money on
right.
healthcare. That's what's just baffling to me. So, you know, the rest of the show, we're going to spend time talking about reasons and solutions to this shorter life expectancy in the United States. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, that's what we're going to dive into. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm Dr. TJ. And today we are talking on the program about shorter life expectancy, and we're also going to talk about, you know, reasons and solutions for this. So as we dive into this, I think of this every time I think about why the U.S. is sicker than other countries and spending more money, is obesity and diabetes. I mean, this stuff is just rampant. We have the highest percentage of adults who are overweight or obese compared to these other 11 countries other 10 countries that we've talked about earlier. Almost 70% of the population is overweight or obese.
Which is just really surprising to me.
If there are four of you in a car, three of you are overweight or obese.
Wow. And it's shocking. And it really, I think, goes in different populations, because I was thinking about this and I really did find it shocking, because I don't know a lot of people that are obese, you know, or even, you know, I mean, overweight, really. I mean, I would not have ever guessed it was that. But I think, well, with us being involved in the healthcare field, it would make sense that we're around people who are very concerned with health
right.
and are really watching that. It's just, I think, surprising to me that the number is that high. But I'm guessing there are a lot of you who are going to be listening to this and you're thinking, nope, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, that makes complete sense.
Makes complete sense. That's exactly right. And what's crazy is when we look at these other 10 countries, our peer countries, their rates of obesity and overweight range from 23.8% up to 63.4. And I just saw a thing. The 63.4 might be a little low because Europe. Not Europe. Great Britain.
Yeah.
Just announced that their obesity and overweight percentage is right at 65%. And they're trying to figure out ways because it's crippling their healthcare system because they're socialized medicine. And so they know that they're not going to have the funds to keep up with, you know, the added costs that go along with this.
Well, and related to that, research shows that American adults age 20 and older have the highest prevalence rate of diabetes among peer countries.
Right. And here's where it gets really interesting. Americans are less likely to smoke than these other peer countries. They drink less alcohol than these other peer countries. But they consume the most calories per person. So we're consuming more food, we're drinking less alcohol, and smoking less. That's what's just baffling to me. This is diet 101 right here.
And plus, I think something that I think is interesting with the United States is that the patterns of food consumption in the U.S. is very much shaped by environmental factors, which means, you know, actions by food and agriculture industries and the foods offered at our grocery stores and restaurants.
Which is exactly what I was just saying in the first thing. If we change what we buy, we alter what's available, and we purchase ourselves into health, and we'll decrease spending by buying better products.
And I agree with you, but I also think then that also supports my argument that our agriculture industry and what our grocery stores and restaurants are offering is dictating what we actually eat. So if they're not making good choices, we don't have as much.
Right, but they're not making good choices because they're forced into buying certain things because that's especially if we get in. I mean, they don't even get me started on schools. I mean, my own mom used to be a cook at the schools, and she got out of that mess because it was just a disaster. Because she understood that what they forced them to purchase as the school was just terrible, poor nutrients, just awful foods, and that's what was had to be fed to kids. And then when they changed portion sizes and limited this and limited that, they're not even feeding these kids enough to have enough energy to go throughout the day, because, you know, a 250-pound 6'4" football player got the same as same food as a 5'10" freshman that hadn't even gone through his growth spurt yet. And that doesn't make any sense.
Well, and they are, you know, generally not high nutrient.
No, it's very nutrient weak food.
Right.
And that's one of the things that we have to focus on is getting the availability of these, you know, nutrient-rich foods to the population, which, again, we affect it by purchasing these things.
Right. Well, and I mean, and I know a lot of the argument, you know, with school lunches is that, well, kids won't eat it if they were really healthy. But where else are kids going to learn it if they're not learning it at home?
Right.
I mean, shouldn't we at least show them what good food is in our schools?
Right.
I mean, that's where they should be learning. And
right.
If we have to, you know, they have to learn healthy eating somewhere. If they're not learning it at home, then I think, you know.
And I mean, let's just take the people that have diabetes. I mean, we actually have to put together a plan that helps reverse or helps people decrease diabetes. I mean, telling them that it's okay to eat carbs and just take extra insulin is not the answer. You can't do it that way.
And
you can't. Do that. And I can't tell you how many people come in, and that's what they've been told. That's what they believe. And I'm like, no, sugar is the problem. You have to get sugar out of your diet. You can't do this another way. You have to stop eating carbs.
Right.
Period. Cut and dry. Eat meat. Eat fat.
It's infuriating to them. Like,
can you tell?
I mean, well, no.
It's infuriating to me.
Right. But it's infuriating to the patients because they're just like, that is not right. That is not what my doctor said. And, you know, it's like okay.
Well, how's that diabetes treating you? Because it's worse now than it was 2 years ago, which is worse than it was 3 years ago, which is worse than it was when you got the thing
so
diagnosed
it's
forever
working,
ago.
Which is why you're in our office.
Right.
So if you want to reverse it, then follow our plan. If you want to keep getting worse, then follow their plan. It's that simple.
Right.
And I mean, that's why I think it's really frustrating because nobody wants to be overweight or obese. We don't want to have diabetes, but, you know, I mean, there are going to have to be some tough changes being made because it's, you know, what's easy in our country is going to lead you to obesity and diabetes.
Right. And then that's going to lead us right into our next one, which is heart disease.
Right.
Because what do people that have obesity and diabetes die from? They die from heart disease. Right. And that's the big one. I mean, we have the death rate in the U.S. from ischemic heart disease is the second highest among, if we expand this out to 17 different countries, we're the second highest. I mean, this is just ridiculous. We spend all this money, but yet we still have raging heart disease. It's still the number one killer by far, by far. And they took stroke, which is still cardiovascular disease, they took stroke out of heart disease, and stroke is the number four killer.
Right.
I mean, if you put those two together, which they really truly are the same thing, you're, oh my right. gosh.
And if people really understand the physiology behind it, they know it's the same
thing. It's the same thing. I mean, you've got, I just saw an article the other day where somewhere their doctors petitioned to be able to, cardiologists to be able to treat people that come in with strokes because there's not enough people that have certifications to treat strokes. Well, you don't need a certification to treat stroke. Eat better.
Well, I mean, but after you have a stroke, there are things. I mean, we
yeah,
do a lot.
That after you have a stroke, right. That's the thing.
We do
I mean,
a
that's
lot
thing.
In our clinic for people who have strokes.
They were
talking,
and they were
out there,
and they were talking about the emergency stuff, being
right.
able to like,
and I understand that
apply medications and things like that. And I understand what they mean because it's so debilitating. If someone were to have a stroke, the added costs and stress on the family of that is just astronomical. So I get what they're saying. But
right. And we see a lot of people with stroke in our office because there aren't a lot of people that are able to treat it.
Right. So, I mean, with heart disease, getting testing done early. I mean, heart disease doesn't develop overnight. You don't wake up one day and all of a sudden you have heart disease. This stuff, we're seeing this start in people younger than 10. We run blood labs in the office, and we see markers for heart disease being elevated under the age of 10.
Right.
This is scary. And, I mean, it's so simple to change. You eat the right foods. You exercise. Get off the couch. Eat the right foods. It's not that difficult.
And I want to say that, I mean, I want to point out that these are in children that do not have absent parents. They have parents who, you know, I mean, they're not being neglected. They
Correct.
Have parents who really are trying to do everything for them. They bring them to our offices. I mean, what better thing can you do for your child than to say, you know what, I'm going to have them tested and see where they're at. And then we find these things. And it's not because, I mean, I think that it's very easy to look at it and say, oh, well, that's just parents who sit their kids in front of the TV
Right.
and just only feed them junk food. That is not generally what we see. We see it in children, and mostly because those are the kids that come into us with children that have very present parents and are trying to do things right, but simply didn't understand what they needed to be feeding their children.
Right, but they know that going to their other doctors and those doctors saying, "Well, your kid is, you know, yep, your kid's 11, but they need blood pressure medication and diabetes medication."
Right. And
they understand that that's not the right answer.
Exactly, the parents are under, you know, I mean, they're intelligent enough to say, wait, that doesn't sound like that's a good plan for my kid. What else can I do? And so we're actually able to work with them. And the great thing is when kids come in, when you've got, you know, any child, I mean, under the age of 18 come in, they've got, it's so much easier to fix at that point.
Yeah. They have the advantage of youth.
Right. Exactly. And you can turn it around. And a lot of times those are simple fixes because they haven't gotten to the point where we need to do these like, you know, crazy things to help fix them. They just simply need a diet change.
Yeah, they don't have a radical change of things that they need to do where they, you know, there may be 10 things that they need to do. They may just have to a couple things that need to do.
Right.
And what's awesome is when the kids have to do it, guess what? Mom and dad do too, and they get a little healthier
exactly.
from it.
But a lot of times what brings people in and what actually gets, you know, like motivates them to change is the fact that their children need to change.
Right.
And it's amazing to me how many parents are wising up and saying, hey, I need to at least go and bring my child in and see where they, you know, are health-wise.
Right.
Where they wouldn't maybe spend it on themselves, you know, do that, put the effort in for themselves. They will for their kids, and everyone is healthier for it.
Right. Exactly. Next on the list is chronic respiratory disease. This is one that I don't think about this much in the United States, but I mean, COPD, asthma, I mean, these things are huge financial burdens to the United States. I mean, this is the fifth leading cause of death in the country. Lots of people suffer from this.
It's huge.
And I mean, there are, you know, the World Health Organization they basically say that chronic respiratory diseases may be caused by environmental factors, things like air pollution, unhealthy housing. I mean, I saw a report, I don't remember exactly when I read it, but talking about housing and buildings in the United States, and they believe that upwards of 50% of houses and buildings in the United States contain mold. So talk about poor indoor air quality, being a building that has mold. But things like that, smoking, occupational exposure, lots of chemicals that have been, you know, approved by the EPA. I mean, we talk about that a lot on the show. You know, there are a lot of 100,000 chemicals that have been approved for use in our land, air, and water. And those things are just hard on our lungs. And so, you know, stop smoking. Try to reduce your exposure to these things. This is the key piece of helping lung function and lung diseases. So when we come back, we got to take another break. We're gonna talk some more about some things that are, you know, driving the shorter life expectancy, but also some solutions that you can do to help increase your life expectancy. You're listening to Wellness 101, and welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm Dr. TJ from the Institute of Natural Health, and with me, as always, is Aaron. If you've been listening, we're halfway through talking today about life expectancy in the United States and why it's shorter, and then reasons why it's shorter, and then why, you know, solutions that you can do or utilize to increase your life expectancy. And this is compared to, you know, basically 10 other countries that are similar to the United States as far as, you know, income and population and things like that. So we just finished, we were talking about chronic respiratory diseases being a key piece of that puzzle. And, you know, I just wanted to add, you know, air quality is a big one. And we didn't throw in there that making sure that you're running some sort of filtration system at your home is a great way to improve air quality inside the house. I mean, there are a lot of studies out there that suggest that indoor air quality is way worse than outdoor air quality. And I know a lot of people that have allergies, they work their best to, you know, to stay indoors as much as they possibly can. And they seal, you know, try to keep their windows sealed up as tight as possible, and they don't ever open their windows. But that's just setting you up for your poor air quality. I mean, have your house checked for radon. That's a big one. Make sure you have some carbon monoxide detectors in the house. Especially if you're, you know, at the area where your garage, you know, if you have a garage where it connects to the house, because we can get lots of carbon monoxide coming in that way. But a nice filtration system. Some people decide to go with a whole house unit. Others just have air filters in various rooms throughout their home. But anything that you can do to decrease the amount of mold, bacteria, viruses, and things like that are floating around in your house will improve air quality inside the house and improve, you know, lung or decrease your risk for respiratory diseases.
Right, because it's an increasing problem. I mean, yeah. I know I go through, you know, in my job as an attorney, I go through a lot of medical records, and it's amazing how many people have been diagnosed with some sort of respiratory illness.
Right.
I mean, it's just extremely prevalent at this point. So, and especially the older that you get. And while, you know, part of that is, you know, just, you know, like we talked about, the occupation that you have, where in the United States you are living, there are a lot of things that you can do to protect yourself.
And then the number one predictor of overall health is lung function. If you have poor lung function, you have a decreased life expectancy, period. It's going to be cut and dried. You're going to have worse health.
It just makes it more difficult to live. I mean, anyone who's dealt with any sort of shortness of breath, you know, I mean,
right.
Something just that simple, not to mention COPD or asthma, knows how debilitating it can be.
Right. So, moving on, next one is drug abuse. This is obviously a hot button, hot topic in this country right now with the epidemic of opioid overdoses and things like that. But we, compared to these other countries, we lose more life and years of our life because of drug abuse than any of the rest of them. I mean, the CDC basically says death by unintentional injuries, which includes drug overdose, has become the third leading cause of death as of 2016 behind heart disease and cancer. Wow. I mean, that's staggering. And I don't know that people realize that that is such a prevalent thing. I mean, the rate of unintentional injuries increased by 9% or 10% basically from 2015 to 2016 with 64,000 drug overdose deaths. The sharpest increase, I mean, is this stuff called fentanyl, and we've heard about fentanyl, and then all these fentanyl analogs. There are a lot of synthetic opioids that are made based off of fentanyl that are way more potent. And I actually just literally yesterday or the day before saw an article, and they were talking about the amount of money from a drug dealer standpoint that can be made from X amount of the drug to start with. And it was literally like heroin produced, you know, like $4,000 or $5,000 or $10,000, whatever it was. And the same amount of fentanyl was in the millions of dollars. I had no idea. It's that mind-boggling, and that it's that big of a moneymaker for those in the drug trade, which is why it's becoming more and more prevalent. We're seeing it more and more, and it's thousands of times more deadly than traditional drugs, and it's being found in all kinds of things. And so, you know, this is a big thing, and I don't have the answers as to, you know, how do you combat that. I don't really know. Educating, helping people as best we can. I mean, there are a lot of things, you know, a lot of people out there that want to say, oh, well, it's gateway drugs and it's this and that. And I don't know if that's true or not. I don't have the answers to that. But the New England Journal of Medicine says that 63% of people who have been prescribed opioid drugs, typically given to them for chronic pain, have reported misusing them. So it's like you give it to someone and they're going to abuse it.
Well, and I think that makes sense to me as someone who has lived in chronic pain because, well, I mean, first of all, we both know that chronic pain generally it should not be treated the same as, you know, acute pain, because chronic pain is something else is going on. You don't need a pain pill to cover it up. You need to find what's causing the pain in the first place.
Right.
So I want to be really clear to anyone out there suffering from chronic pain that we're certainly not saying that you don't need something for the, you know,
right,
for the pain. But the answer is to figure out what's causing it and not to simply, I mean, opioids are just covering it up.
Right.
I mean, these prescription painkillers aren't.
Well, and two, you know, one
which
of the,
I think is what leads to misuse was my point.
I don't disagree with that at all. But another piece of this too is, you know, I think that we could benefit from people who get themselves, you know, hooked on these drugs. I think they could benefit from having better access to, you know, substance abuse centers and programs, as opposed to just treating them like a criminal of like, oh my gosh, you know, you've got 28 pills of this and your prescription and blah, blah, whatever they're doing to arrest everyone. They're obviously addicted. I don't think anyone really truly wants to be addicted to painkillers.
Right. Well, I mean, but
they just need help and they don't know how to get off of these things.
I agree. I think that's part of it. And I also think we need more people like, you know, our clinic, more places out there that actually can figure out what's causing the pain in the first place. Because if it's acute pain, like when you've gone through a surgery or something in that period, that short period afterwards, of course you're going to be in pain. And that's what these painkillers were meant to treat. But as far as chronic pain, when we're dealing with chronic pain, that's not what painkillers were ever designed to deal with anyway. And I can also say, you know, I mean, I had tried that when I was in chronic pain. It doesn't actually get rid of the pain. That's why people misuse them.
Right. Yeah. So another one, moving from drug abuse, is infant deaths. This is really, this was this one really caught me off guard. The United States has the highest infant mortality rate, 5.8 deaths per 1,000 live births, compared to other countries that have a rate of about 3.6 deaths per deaths per live birth. I mean, that's two more per every 1,000 babies born. I mean, that the leading cause of death that they say, according to the CDC, are birth defects, low birth weight due to preterm birth, sudden infant death syndrome, and maternal pregnancy complications. I mean, the CDC itself, their basic recommendations for this to lower this is address social, behavioral, and health risk factors that contribute to infant mortality. Well, to me, the social stuff, that goes back to that happiness study of, you know, really what that boils down to. I'm not sure about the behavioral stuff. I don't know if that's, you know, bad behaviors, you know, drinking while pregnant or, you know, smoking, or I don't know what that boils down to. But the health risk factors, those things can easily be addressed, especially if we're talking about things like, you know, women who are pregnant that have diabetes. I mean, what if we could prevent diabetes in the first place? What if we could give them high quality nutrition where they would be healthier overall to begin with? That's going to help. You have a healthier mama, healthier eggs, a healthier dad, you're going to have a healthier baby, period. I mean, there's no way around it. If you have a sick mom, you have an increased risk of having a sick baby.
Right, and I think that has a lot to do. I mean, you know, we've talked about this on the before about, you know, the rising rates of infertility and a lot of people going through infertility treatments. And we have said before, we need to get the people healthy in the first place before we send them on to things, you know, to go through things like IVF.
Right.
Because if they
gotta
the mother
be healthy
isn't
to start.
Healthy, this isn't good for the mom or the baby. You know, eventual baby to get them pregnant.
Right. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about another couple of pieces, and then we're going to offer up some final thoughts. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just tuning in, you have missed a pretty good show on the United States life expectancy. We have a shorter life expectancy in the U.S., reasons why the life expectancy is shorter, and then things that can be done that you can do to improve your chance at a longer life and hopefully a longer, healthier life, because just longer doesn't mean anything. We want as much health there as we can possibly get. But right before the break, we were talking about infant deaths and infant mortality rates being higher than the rest of the countries that the United States are compared to. And so moving on from that, the next one on the list is homicides and injuries, specifically gun violence. And this is a big one. It's always a hot button topic. It always is divisive in people that are talking about it. I mean, the numbers are pretty solid. I mean, we have very high homicide rates in certain areas and certain cities in the country. I mean, St. Louis is where we live is obviously one of the top. You have things like Detroit. That's another one. Not to throw Detroit under the bus, but we're always up there in the top 10. I mean, this is just I don't know how to help with that. But you know. Injuries, it's not just homicides, it's also injuries. And these are things like accidents, not wearing a seatbelt in a car crash. Those are important,
right,
as well.
Drinking while driving.
Yeah.
Texting while driving.
Yeah, texting while driving is becoming a big deal. I mean, how frustrating is it when you're driving down the road and you look over and this guy's swerving over into your lane, you get up beside them and you realize that they got their cell phone up by their face. I mean, that infuriates me.
Especially, you know, with a baby in the car.
Yeah.
You just think, seriously?
Like, what in the world are you doing? But anyway, so those are this is a topic that I don't really know how to address those issues. I mean, the things like, you know, seatbelts, making sure you're wearing your seatbelt, things like, you know, don't text while you drive. Those are obvious things that can do. I'm not sure what to say about the, you know, homicides and gun violence. You know, I think there's stuff that needs to be done. I'm not sure what.
Right. We just need to throw it in because it is one of the reasons.
It's one of the reasons. It's exactly right. It's one of the reasons. Just like another one is sexually transmitted infections. Compared to the rest of the world, really, basically, or the countries that we're constantly compared to, adolescents in the United States are less likely to practice safe sex than those in other countries. And, you know, in the U.S., people are becoming more sexually active at younger and younger ages, and they tend to have more sexual partners. This is probably why, you know, STDs are on the rise. I mean, if you listen to we watch Dr. Phil. Aaron watches Dr. Phil.
I did on my maternity leave.
I get the benefit of it. But Dr. Phil talks about things like, you know, a child's brain isn't fully developed. They're not able to make, you know, long-term choices at young ages. And so if you have kids that are, you know, young teenagers, their brains aren't fully developed to be able to, you know, make choices about things that they may have lifelong consequences about, and they make poor choices. And so this could be definitely a contributing factor to, you know, the increased rates of STDs. I mean, it's just, it's pretty mind-boggling what's going on there and the rates. I mean, we're showing, you know, record highs, 19% higher rates of gonorrhea and things like that. I mean, this is just stuff that's just like, oh my gosh, what do we got to do? I mean, this is a public health nightmare.
Right.
Is what this is. And, you know, this is why I didn't get into public health, because I don't know how you combat that. I mean, I don't know where you go. I mean, there are so many outside forces that are, you know, fighting against anything that a parent may be trying to teach and instill values that they may be trying to instill in their kids. I don't even know where to begin with that. But all of this leads us to what I think is the biggest piece of this puzzle, and it's just a complete failing healthcare system in the United States. I mean, the whole system is set up. It's not working. It hasn't worked for a while. It works great if you have an emergency, if you have, you know, a life-threatening bacterial infection that you need to kill, but it does not do anything for long-term chronic disease, and it hasn't for a long time. These diseases are complex. They have complex risk factors. There's complex things that are going on. And the United States, most doctors are practicing defensive medicine rather than preventive medicine. And there's a big difference between defensive and preventive. Defensive is just cover your butt, do what you need to do so you're not sued for something that may go wrong with a person, rather than, hey, you know what? Let's figure out what we can do with this person to help them not develop the disease process in the first place. It's a whole lot cheaper to prevent a heart attack than it is to have one, because a heart attack right now in this country costs about $1 million. And most people don't earn $1 million in their lifetime. So that just tells me it's way cheaper if we prevent it from the very beginning. Right.
I mean, and not just, you know, and not just from a financial standpoint. I mean, it's just your quality of life is so much greater.
Right.
I mean, there are so many reasons to prevent these things.
But people get finances. People understand dollars.
Right.
People don't get quality of life until they don't have their quality of life.
And I think that's why, you know, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, is that, you know, I come from the perspective of having lost my health at one point, that it makes it that much more important. I get it, you know, how difficult it is when you aren't healthy, that now it just doesn't make sense to me why people would not want to do everything they can to prevent ever being in that situation.
Right. I mean, it's just... The whole system is broken, in my opinion. I mean, you know, final thoughts on this show for today. Thanks for listening, for sure. Life expectancy, again, like we said at the very beginning, 78.8 years in the United States. In our peer countries, 80.7 to 83.9 years. And these are countries that are high income. I mean, it's pretty obvious that spending more money and throwing more money at the problem isn't fixing anything. All we're doing is throwing more money at it year after year, and we're getting sicker and sicker and sicker. The whole system needs a change. We need to focus more on prevention. We need to focus more on functional medicine. Functional medicine is where it's at. That's how you get to decrease healthcare costs overall, is to figure out what's actually going on with a person or do the things that are necessary to prevent the disease from happening in the first place.
Yeah. Prevent it, and once it's there, fix it
fix
at its
it.
Cause.
Correct.
At the root cause.
So that's about all the time that we have today. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you want more information, please visit our website, theinstituteofnaturalhealth.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, email us. We love to hear from you. For Aaron, I'm Dr. TJ. This has been Wellness 101. Thanks for listening.